This is the Tasmanian Country Hour with Fiona Breen on ABC Radio Hobart and Tasmania.
Good afternoon and welcome to the program. Today we talk about feral deer, and one farmer gives us the numbers on income lost. Chemical giant Monsanto bracing for thousands of lawsuits over an alleged link between its commonly used weed killer, Roundup, and cancer. And Australians could be among them.
The expert evidence that has developed for the trials in the United States, that's something that an Australian lawyer, Australian plaintiffs would be able to potentially try to mimic or follow as well if they wanted to bring a case here.
And a new program designed to inspire young women to take on a career in agriculture.
We're all equal in the industry now. It doesn't matter what industry you're in, whether it's firefighting or having a trade, being an electrician or a diesel fitter, you can do it.
And closer to one, we'll speak to a lamb processor in Victoria about high prices and its effect on business. And, of course, we have livestock reporter Richard Bailey on the week's sales. But first, one of Tasmania's wool producers is frustrated at a growing feral deer problem on his farm. He says it's costing him $50,000 a year in income. Simon Cameron farms merino sheep on his property Kingston in northeast Tasmania. We spoke about his frustration with deer eating him out of potential profits. But first, we chatted about the uniqueness of his property.
We're very fortunate at Kingston because of its location and because of the way it's been managed over quite a number of years. It retains significant natural values. I have to give credit to my father, who managed the farm very conservatively for maybe 55 years, and I've added another 15 to that. So perhaps there's 70 years there of conservative management, which has allowed large tracts of lowland native grasslands to thrive, I guess you can say.
And that's actually been recognised nationally.
There are people that believe that it is of national significance. The importance in the Tasmanian context is that it's on a landscape scale. I believe that there's very little, in fact only 3% of the lowland native grassland communities remain in Tasmania that were here at European settlement. And of that 3%, about 10% are found on one farm, and that's at Kingston.
Now, you run merino sheep on the farm and produce a high-quality wool that goes into men's suiting, and that's going well. You've just signed a new marketing contract?
Yes, Matt Jensen, the CEO of MJ Bale, and I have reached agreement on what we call the third vintage, which is a shared project between myself, an Italian fabric manufacturer called Vitali Barberis Canonico, and Matt's chain of retail stores, MJ Bale. And it's really nice to see that this has progressively grown over 3 years. It started off with about 45 bales, and now this year they've taken all the suitable wool that I can produce. That's over 60 bales of suitable wool. And in fact, they would have taken more had I been able to produce it.
You have feral deer on your property, and that's affecting production. Tell me about what you think the numbers are.
It's really hard to get a handle on the numbers. Based on what we have culled, I've been told that we're hosting perhaps between 600 and 1,000 deer, maybe not all at one time, but there are a large number of deer that the impact of this is that I cannot run the number of sheep that I would be able to otherwise run. The hassle for me is we're not allowed to control the deer to the extent that we need to, such is the priority given to recreational hunting over agriculture.
How much income do you think it's displacing?
My estimate at the moment is about $50,000 a year. There are two ways of looking at that number. One is that it's a direct loss to the farm. But a better way of looking at that is what that volume of wool would generate in terms of economic value. And the formula that I've used and stand behind is that $50,000 worth of wool is about the equivalent of 500 sheep that I can't run. Each of the fleeces of those sheep would translate into a couple of suits, and we're missing out on about $1 million of value at the retail level. That's economic wealth that would be generated but isn't.
Have you noticed any changes since the formation of the new game management committee?
In terms of the Tasmanian Game Council, no, there's been no tangible outcomes. I believe they're still working towards a recommendation to put to the minister. There are some issues with that. I have an issue with the composition of the council. I think while the recreational hunting organisations were adequately represented, it was curious that there were three guys and one from each of the major recreational hunting organisations. On the farming side, there are also three representatives. Two of those are from outside what's known as the core deer range, which is the main area that's up for debate when it comes to deer control.
So not enough farmers, is that what you're saying?
I'm not saying not enough farmers, I'm saying not the perhaps farmers with a greater knowledge of the real situation and understanding the background and what it takes to control deer. The council would have benefited from greater involvement of that type of farmer. The other thing about the council is that the minister is not bound to do anything by any recommendation that would come out of that council. That reflects the general way that deer are managed in the state.
So you want urgent action?
We really need to come to terms with the wild deer population.
We need a census, and we're due to get that, aren't we?
Look, the census, which has been promised for some time. Yes, it will help with longer-term decision-making, but I don't need a census to tell you that there are far too many deer on my farm. I need to be able to control them year-round now.
You'd like a season all year-round?
Yes, look, I think that that's the only way that we can effectively keep the deer population under control or push them back is to have an open season on deer.
Have you had any response to this? Have you suggested this before?
I have requested the minister give us greater access to culling permits. That response was declined.
I sense your frustration, so it's a problem that's really affecting your business.
My operation is a small one. It's a significant opportunity cost that I'm missing out on about 15% of my wool income as a result of the deer that I have to host. And it's a significant burden in other ways in terms of running the farm and just the challenges that managing the deer population present.
And that was a frustrated Simon Cameron. He farms merino sheep on his property, Kingston, in northeast Tasmania, but he's battling to expand while feral deer are eating through his paddocks. Now to recreational hunters, and they've been allowed in reserves this deer hunting season in an attempt to help control the numbers of fallow deer in wilderness areas. It follows the 2018 recommendations from an upper house inquiry into Tasmania's wild fallow deer population. I chatted to Lee Neesey, President of Field Hunting and Conservation Tasmania, about the season so far and hunting in those newly opened reserve areas.
I guess we won't hear a lot until the deer season finishes, and then we'll get reports back in when they fill their tag numbers and that in and their returns. But from the feedback I've gotten, there's not a lot of deer being seen in those places. Some of them had to been closed this year too because of the bushfires in the Central Plateau, so that's made it a bit harder again. And it seems to have pushed a lot of deer off there into other areas that have farms that have normally got access and shooting on them anyway.
So you're saying the fires have pushed deer out of those World Heritage areas, for example?
Yes, they have. In some of those areas there was top marshes and the 5 mile pinnacle and places like that were open to recreational hunting. There's nothing there at present. It's blackened and it's just pushed the deer out of there. The deer numbers are gone.
Well, we're soon to hear about the census on deer numbers in Tasmania. What's your feeling about deer numbers and what's your feeling about the census?
Yeah, well, I don't know how that's going to be done. really. It's a guesswork. There's no way we can ever do that, really. And the deer numbers have increased. There's no doubt about that. And it's become a problem on some farms. It's a major problem. Yeah, I don't know where we're going ahead with that. It's got to be looked into. The game management unit that was operating out of Longford, that's been disbanded. Now it's Game Services Tasmania. There doesn't seem to be a lot of feedback to hunters on that. I don't know where it's really going. It's gone dead.
Well, that's a new committee, isn't it? So you're saying you haven't heard much about it?
No. We've, as recreational hunters, I don't know of anyone that's received anything back from that. We certainly haven't as an organisation, state organisation, as to where it's going or what's been achieved or anything.
How are hunters going at the moment this season? Have they been getting many deer?
Those people that have got access to the properties where there is a lot of deer are seeing huge numbers of deer. Huge numbers. I know where I shoot at Bothwell, the numbers have increased dramatically because the amount of game that's been displaced from up on the Central Plateau. They've been pushed down that way. There's a major problem on some of those farms or in fringe benefit farms down there. There is major problems.
Are hunters getting enough access to shooting or to areas to shoot?
Those people, most of the farms have been tied up for a long term, and those people are getting a lot of deer, but the new ones coming into the system are the ones I feel sorry for, where they're coming in now, and they're only getting the fringe properties around, and there's not a lot of deer on those, or there have been people shooting deer there anyway prior to it. Yeah, and that's not happening. And I feel sorry for those ones that are paying for a licence and not getting a deer.
So we've got people that want to go out and catch deer. We've supposedly got too much deer. What's the answer there?
I think that the tags that we're getting and the licence, the season closes the 30th of June this year for deer licences. Those people that haven't got tags, they just become dead, and I feel sorry for those guys. They've paid for those tags and not going to be able to use them. We increased the tag numbers from 2 to 3, but yet the deer take hasn't greatly increased during the deer season. The only numbers that have increased are those people that can get Cullen tags later on and shoot on the properties where they've got major problems with deer.
So you expect by the end of the season there might be some people that will still have a tag or two left but are no longer able to hunt?
There will be a lot, yeah. It works out. Now, the last figures I actually seen, the deer licence sales in a decade had increased by about, I think, 4,000 or something, but the deer take still hadn't increased. The same people were still getting deer, but the new people coming in weren't getting deer. That's the way I read it from the statistics I was seeing.
And yet deer numbers are supposedly increasing.
Yeah, sometimes I wonder whether we're paying lip service to this, you know, what we're going to do about the deer numbers. I know that I'm shooting more deer simply because I've been on a property for a number of years now, and we were able to get culling tags and cull deer. I know I'm shooting more deer than I was ever shooting, but I still feel sorry for those people that are paying for licences not getting deer. It's dead money.
So a few questions there from farmers and from hunters about what's happening with the Tasmanian Game Council. We have contacted the Department of Primary Industry and we hope to have someone on the program tomorrow. But you just heard Lee Neesey, President of Field Hunting and Conservation Tasmania.
Saturday morning down the garden path.
Now, I do have something serious to talk to you about, Tino.
With Tino and Joel.
I hear that you've been eating another man's tomatoes, Tino.
When there's no callers, all options are on the table.
There's a lot of tomato love to go around, Joel. There's more than enough to go around.
I don't want you spreading your tomato love around, Tino. I thought we had an exclusive tomato deal going on between us here.
I thought we were very open here, Joel.
Keep the calls coming and get Tino and Joel back on message. Saturday mornings on ABC Radio Hobart.
The Tasmanian Country Hour with Fiona Breen on ABC Radio Hobart and Tasmania.
And chemical giant Monsanto is bracing for thousands of lawsuits over an alleged link between its commonly used weed killer Roundup and cancer. Yesterday, a jury in California ordered the company to pay $2 billion to a couple who claimed their cancer was caused by the herbicide. It's the third time A jury in the United States has found Roundup responsible for causing cancer. But Monsanto and its owner, Bayer, maintain the product is safe to use. Michael Leake is Professor of Law at the University of New South Wales and a member of the Law Council of Australia's Class Actions Committee. He spoke to RN's Frank Kelly this morning about the likelihood of these US cases having an impact in Australia.
It couldn't be used as a precedent. So an American decision is not going to bind an Australian court. But I think it's more that the expert evidence that is developed for the trials in the United States, that's something that an Australian lawyer, Australian plaintiffs would be able to potentially try to mimic or follow as well if they wanted to bring a case here.
So if legal action was to be launched in Australia, could expert evidence used in the US form part of a court case here?
They'd need to get their own expert evidence, but they would certainly be able to, I guess, use it as a sort of a template as to the way or what needed to be proved.
If there was action taken, we don't have payouts anything like this amount generally in Australia, do we? Even if it was to be proven, and we're leaping way ahead, obviously, of anything. I'm not presuming anything.
No, I mean, the payments in Australia are generally much smaller. And it's this comparison between American payouts and Australian payouts, I guess, came to the fore in the DePoy hip implants class action, because a number of the group members there were looking at the recovery they were making in Australia and comparing it to what had happened in the United States. And the judge there, Justice Wigney, basically said, to quote him, it's an entirely different ballgame. We just calculate the damages very differently.
Here in Australia, the National Farmers Federation maintains the active ingredient in Roundup, which is the chemical glyphosate, has been through a rigorous process of approval. And the Australian Pesticides and Veterinary Medicines Authority also says Roundup is safe to use. On the flip side, 3 years ago, the World Health Organization, the International Agency for Research of Cancer, classified glyphosate as, quote, probably carcinogenic to humans. But that's not declaratory in any way. So would you say that the assessment from Australia's own regulatory body would undermine the case for legal action here? Is that a difference too?
Look, the way that I think it would work is there would have been information or evidence put to the regulator to be able to demonstrate that Roundup was safe. But at the same time, what we're seeing from the United States is alternative evidence or alternative studies suggesting the opposite. And so a court case wouldn't be a situation where they would simply go with what the regulator had found. The court would be required to consider, if you like, both sides of the story. So that information that had been given to the regulator could be reused to defend Roundup, but it certainly wouldn't foreclose there being an action.
And that was Professor Michael Leake from the University of New South Wales talking about that court action against chemical giant Monsanto in the US yesterday and the success of that couple winning a payout with links to their claiming their links to their cancer was linked to the herbicide Roundup. Now, Australia will import grain for the first time since 2007. The Agricultural Department has approved a shipment of Canadian bulk wheat to arrive in 6 to 8 weeks. Kath Sullivan has more.
Following months of industry speculation, the Department of Agriculture late yesterday confirmed it had approved a permit to import bulk wheat. The wheat will be used at a starches facility at Nowra in southern New South Wales. In a statement, Manildra Group said that high-protein wheat was in short supply due to the worst drought in 116 years, and the permit to import would help Manildra Group to secure hundreds of regional jobs. This morning, Agriculture Minister David Littleproud said there were no politics behind the decision to approve the permit.
Well, biosecurity is always left to the department rather than politicians, and it should always be done. I've made sure that the application that was put towards us, that I understand the department's been has approved, has been provided to the opposition so that they're fully cognizant of the decision that the department has made. This is not a new development. We have had grain imports before. The reality is the drought has impacted significantly the supply of grain, and it's been done with very strict conditions to make sure that there's a closed loop and consultation with the grain industry. And I've got to congratulate the grain industry for the maturity in which they have handled this. They have welcomed this so long as these importers continue to support them when conditions turn. And I think they've enjoyed that support from these processes. But there are jobs at risk if we don't have a pragmatic approach to this, and grain growers have done that in a very sensible way.
Opposition spokesman Joel Fitzgibbon.
The key point here is that we are now in need of imported grain, and that should be a wake-up call to a government which has been in complete denial on climate change and unwilling to take the agriculture sector on a new plane where they are learning to adapt to climate change and maintaining their productivity. So that's the key point here. But all Australians should be concerned that out of government inaction, we are now in a position, a great agriculture country like Australia, where we're having to import our grains.
Xavier Martin is a grain grower on the Liverpool Plains in New South Wales. He says Australia's biosecurity status is constantly falling, and he does not believe there is a need to import any grain.
Firstly, I'm quite surprised that there's been a permit issued, given the amount of grain available from Western Australia, and also the grain that's still on farm in the weak sheep belt through the eastern states. I'm just looking at my silos now that are still full of wheat and sorghum. And, you know, there's plenty of trucks on the road carting grain.
The ABC understands that it's a high-protein wheat that is going to be imported for milling, and it's likely that the application has been in train for some time. Given that we did have such a drought-devastated harvest on the East Coast in particular, can you understand how the department or how the process may have led to this?
I can understand the theory behind an application, and often we don't see these cargoes shipped. They're just used to massage prices down to throw a scare into the market. And certainly prices for grain in the East Coast here have fallen 20 or 25% really from their peak just prior to harvest last spring, early summer. Well, I come back to the point that it is quite surprising, no matter what the quality is, that it isn't available from somewhere within the grain belt of this nation. The reality is we've got to look after our own island. We're losing our status at the rate of one or two a month. I mean, a couple of decades ago, there was about more than 1,000 pests and diseases that we didn't have in this nation that existed overseas, and we've frittered that down to, I would estimate, around 600 or 700 pests and diseases that still don't exist here. And it's a responsibility of all of us as citizens to protect our environment. And, you know, if these sorts of risks that some people think are manageable, and I would call unmanageable, do result in a pest or disease migrating to this nation and it affects farmers, well, farmers will be expecting those that made the decisions on behalf of the citizens of this nation to foot the bill. You know, if it does ruin farm businesses, if it does impact on their prosperity, then the citizens need to pick up the tab.
And prior to this permit approval, the department told the ABC it was processing 11 applications to import bulk grain into Australia. Now, have you seen a bee with a tiny microchip? Many beekeepers across the globe, including Tasmania, microchip their bees as part of a CSIRO project to put a halt on disease and declining bee populations. Amanda Collins and Scott Denno from Ballarat recently joined the project and hope to make a difference.
Actually, originally we were gifted a hive from one of Scott's former work colleagues, and we just had this one lonely hive that was delivered after dark in the back of a station wagon from Buninyong, and we really didn't think too much about it, about this beehive in our backyard, and that was during winter, so there was not a lot happening for the bees. So after that, we kind of had a very quick and, would you say, prosperous kind of journey into beekeeping.
And what are you focusing on now?
Well, at the moment, we're still focusing on learning, because beekeeping is one of those crafts where you're always learning. But one of the projects we're undertaking is with the CSIRO, and it's the Global initiative for honeybee health, which is really good. It's fun. There's a lot of interaction with the bees, but away from the bees, there's a lot of interaction with the data that comes out of that. So, yeah, it's really good fun.
What exactly do you do?
Well, the project itself has a number of different components, and one of those is actually tagging the bees. So tagging the working bees with these tiny little microchips, which are able to be read through the modified entrance of the beehive. So it has an RFID reader where the bees come and go who have the chip. It's actually recorded. And each time their journey is recorded after a period of time, so we download the data each week and that gets sent back to the CSRO. And I guess the other parts are really around weighing of the hive, and also a probe in the brood box amongst the brood, and that's really to monitor temperature and humidity of the brood box as well.
And Scott, we've looked at the chips before. They're really, really tiny. How difficult is it to fit them onto the bees?
Well, I'm not very good at it. I have to wear my reading glasses. I'm no longer a young man. But for me, it takes just under a minute. That's to get the chip ready in the forceps and to apply the glue and then to select the bee, hold the bee down, and then get the chip in exactly the right position on the bee, and then hopefully get the forceps off the chip without the chip sticking to the forceps. It's a fun game.
How many bees have you chipped so far?
Probably six sessions at about 100 chips, so about 600 odd, yeah, about 600, I reckon.
How many more are there to go?
Well, because we're coming into winter, we've actually finished chipping for the season, so we call it the season. In spring, we'll start doing 50 per week. That'll get a lot of young bees chipped, and hopefully those bees will last, you know, we'll get some good data from each lot of bees coming through. So between grand final day and then the season sort of finishes about Anzac Day. So every week between those two times, we'll be chipping.
And you've mentioned the data then gets sent to Hobart in Tasmania, where the main base for the project is. Where is the project up to at the moment?
Well, my understanding is that Victoria, both Ballarat and the Geelong site, which has also come online recently, are the only two locations in Victoria. There's a couple more, I believe, in New South Wales and in other parts of Australia. And with the majority of the bees being tagged or part of this project in South America, America, and there's some areas within Europe as well. So it's been running for around 5 years, and it's really a culmination of bringing all that data together. So in some ways, its focus was also around, instead of scientists individually collecting data and that data being a part of their own projects and it not relating to any other data globally. This project is an open source data project, which means that data will be available for scientific research across the world, which means that there's, you know, much greater impact, and particularly for beekeepers, scientists, for farmers and anybody who needs pollination services. So it's, I mean, our role is very, very small, but it's good to think that, you know, as kind of citizen scientists in our backyard with our beehive, that we could potentially have like a global impact on the health of honeybees.
And that was beekeeper Amanda Collins and Scott Denno speaking to Jessica Schrimmer from Ballarat. Time for the weather now. Let's go to the Bureau and Luke Johnston. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, how are you?
Really good, thank you. Have we had much rainfall about?
There was a little bit up to 9 a.m. this morning. It was all about the west, though. 11 millimetres was the highest at Mount Reid, and most of the rest of the west coast was under 5 millimetres, with a few exceptions like Cradle Mountain, closer to 7 millimetres. Since 9 a.m, there's really only been showers about the west and far south, so Strawn's actually got the most in the last couple of hours. They're up to 1 millimetre since 9 a.m, and Mount Sike is almost half a millimetre, just in some passing showers. They're fairly persistent, but quite light, so lots of showers adding up to not much, really. What's driving all of this is a ridge of high pressure to the north, directing westerly winds over Tasmania and sustaining some generally light showers about the west and far south, but remaining fine elsewhere and quite clear about much of the central and northeastern areas of the state. We're not going to see much more than about another millimetre or so to the west, and certainly no rainfall in the east of the state today. Tomorrow is looking like a very similar day. To be honest, today you could take a snapshot of today, and that's what tomorrow will be. Temps into the mid to the high teens again. It'll be the warmest in the northeast. Might even have some morning fog patches around too, as we saw some fog in the Midlands and Tamar Valley this morning.
Okay, sounds interesting. So are we up to the outlook then?
If you call Friday an outlook, yeah. The high centre driving all of this gradually moves into the Tasman Sea on Friday, and that'll give us a more northwesterly flow and some more showers about the west coast, but otherwise another fine day with a bit of fog around in the morning. The big story on Friday would be a low developing over the Bight, but it's not really going to get to us until Monday. So Saturday, election day.
Election Saturday, yeah. Yes. So we're going to have a nice day so we can walk to the booth.
Well, depends where you are, but probably, given that most people don't live in the southwest of Tassie. There's a little front that decays as it reaches our south coast, coming from the southwest. So it'll bring some more showers to the southwest and the far south. But really, if you're anywhere north and east of Strawn to the northern island of Bruny Island, northern part of Bruny Island, you should be fine. So that's most Tasmanians. Should be quite a nice day. It'll be slightly cooler than what we see today and the next couple of days, but it'll still have temperatures into the mid to high teens again.
Okay.
And some morning fog.
Sounds pretty good then. So in that case, is there any warnings?
No warnings at all. We're warnings free for rest of today and tomorrow, and it looks like we might just scrape away without many warnings for the next few days.
Oh, good. Okay. And what about the coastal waters?
Yeah, coastal waters today. Turn the page. Westerly winds, 10 to 20 knots, although lighter and more variable about the east coast. Tomorrow, there's more of a west-northwestwards tendency to be 10 to 15 knots, and the swell today about the west is around 3 metres from the west to southwest. Through the Bass Strait, westerly to 1 metre, and the east, southerly swell 1 to 2 metres, although southwesterly 3 metres offshore in the south.
Okay, and what about that wave rider?
Oh, sorry. The wave rider buoy has been a consistent 3.5 metres now for the last couple of hours, and other swell observations are a little bit outdated now. But we saw 2.5 metres at Matsaika Island and 1.5 metres from the southwest at Bruny Island this morning.
Fabulous. Thanks very much, Luke Johnson from the Bureau.
You're welcome.
The most bizarre, unexpected, unimaginable thing.
Australia's most downloaded podcast.
It's like conversations you need to have sometimes.
An hour.
1 hour.
We have more connections in our brain than there are stars in the Milky Way.
Wow. Two mics.
Two microphones.
Equivalent to 8.4 million cane toads.
Unforgettable stories.
You can't talk. You're lying there, totally helpless. The mask is over you.
Look for Conversations wherever you get your podcasts or via the ABC Listen app.
The Tasmanian Country Hour with Fiona Breen on ABC Radio Hobart and Tasmania.
And make sure you stay with us right through to 1 o'clock. And just before the top of the hour, we'll have Richard Bailey with the latest on the markets. But first, it's hoped a new program showcasing field-based careers will inspire young women to consider positions traditionally underrepresented by females. The Department of Primary Industry has been running workshops in regional high schools called See It, Dream It, Do It. Larissa Smith dropped into one of those sessions.
At Scottsdale High, a large group of Year 9 and 10 girls are gathered in groups around women in various uniforms. From park rangers to police, there's scientists and a bit of high vis in the mix too. It's all about getting a feel for what careers are out there for females in operational roles. The event has been organised by Emily Presnell.
So the See It, Dream It, Do It project is a new initiative being run by DePipri. The aim is to increase the visibility of the variety of operational and field-based roles that we have on offer in our department. And the reason is these are roles that have traditionally been underrepresented by women. So what we're doing with See It, Dream It, Do It is we are inspiring young girls to seek employment in these careers if they wish to, and we're challenging stereotypes. And these are jobs that are for women as well as for men.
Kirsty Chalmers is the assistant manager at Huon Aquaculture's Springfield Hatchery. She told the students her path to marine science wasn't entirely straightforward.
Since I was about four, I wanted to be a marine biologist. But then when I was going through school, I realised that I could not do maths and science. I actually failed maths and science in high school. And then next thing you know, I managed to go through TAFE and do aquaculture and get sort of back door to that dream of being the marine biologist, but in a different way. I've been doing this field for about 18 years now, and it's all been along the lines of growing some form of fish species. I can say if you do work experience in a field that you're interested in, that's the best place to start.
So what are you going to do when you leave school?
Parks and wildlife, so...
Sweet, awesome.
You're going to like me even more.
I'm going to love you even more. What do you want to do?
I'm not sure.
Awesome, that's what happened when I left school. I had no bloody idea. I was telling the other girls, when I worked for Queensland Parks, I got bitten by a snake and chopper to the hospital.
Hi, my name's Dominique Cousins. I'm the ranger in charge here up at Scottsdale Field Centre for the Parks and Wildlife Service. I've been up here since 2001, so a long time now. And before I was in Tasmania Parks and Wildlife Service, I was in Queensland, and I worked for the Queensland Parks and Wildlife Service up there for 6 years. I fell into this industry. I was actually in hospitality for a long time. And when I moved to Australia from England, I moved to Airlie Beach, and a ranger lived at the end of my street. And he knew that I wasn't very happy in the hospitality industry. And he said, hey, why don't you come and volunteer for Parks and Wildlife Service? What better place to volunteer than Airlie Beach in the Whitsunday Islands? So that's what I did. I was up against a lot of male employees who were also in temporary positions, and I was still a volunteer. And they said, hey, Dom, you know what? You're up against these guys, and this guy over there, he's a qualified plumber. That guy over there is a qualified carpenter. And that guy over there, he's a skipper of the boat. So when you go for a job, you're up against those three. One of them are going to get it because they've got a trade.
Have you had similar barriers throughout your career as a ranger being a woman?
Absolutely. A lot of it was water off a duck's back, and I never picked up on a lot of stuff, to be honest. It never entered my head. And I did come across a lot of barriers. A really good example I gave the girls this morning was when I was in Queensland, I had a visitor ask me if they could talk to a ranger, and I was in a ranger's uniform. And I said to them, yeah, hi, I'm Dominique, how can I help you? I'm the ranger here. And they said, oh no, we want to talk to a ranger. Things are changing. I just get on and do my job. Told all the girls this morning they can do anything. We're all equal in the industry now. It doesn't matter what industry you're in, whether it's firefighting or having a trade, being an electrician or a diesel fitter, you can do it.
So my name is Ella Curtin. I live at Cranbrook and I work on Brook Lodge Estate, and I'm a farmhand there, or a gillaroo as I'm also known.
How did you get into that field?
So this is a career I've always chosen to do. Through someone that I was doing work experience with, a horse riding school, found out that there was a job going on a farm, and I made contact with those people and got the job, and that's my current boss now. So I have never gone to university, and that was something that I did once try for, but I realised that I needed to be more hands-on and wanted to get out there straight away and get the more experienced side. So people that go to uni for the 3 years, they probably don't quite have as much experience as what I do of working straight away on the land. So I've done TAFE courses. I've done my Animal Studies Cert 2. I did that through my college. And I've also finished my Animals Ag Cert 3 with my boss on a traineeship.
Did you have any female role models growing up in that ag space that encouraged you to go down this path?
Not as such, but there's also the throwback of McLeod's Daughters that every little girl watched, I think, yeah. Through high school, like, if there were any talks about universities, it was all about business studies or law or medicine, things like that, and I was just itching to find someone to talk to me about agriculture. Like, that was what I was after. So definitely I hope that today I can convert one girl to see a future in agriculture.
So what can you take away from today?
Like, all the people that have come in today has really opened my eyes to
a lot of different career paths that I wouldn't have really thought about and things that I thought were more male dominant and I wouldn't have gone for. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. It's showed a lot about the way you act in front of people. It's a lot more about how you present yourself as a person and, yeah, what interests you.
Do you think there are barriers to getting into some of these jobs as a young female?
Yeah, I think there's definitely barriers, but from what I've heard today, they're getting a lot easier to get through, and there's a lot of support systems in place now to help young women find these jobs.
Scottsdale High Year 9 students Taylor Gofton and Amelia Barnett taking part in the Department of Primary Industries See It, Dream It and Do It program. In terms of male-dominated industries, you'd have to say that cattle stud breeding would be up there. When Chelsea Rayner was at school, she was partnered with stud owners as part of the Sheffield School Cattle Handling Program. She now runs her own stud of Simmental cattle and recently won a scholarship to attend a leadership program at Marcus Oldham.
They're a Swiss breed originating from the Swiss Alps, quite known for their dual purpose, so both their meat and their milking ability. I myself have been a fan of them for their being a European cattle, for their muscle, their shape and their carcass attributes that they offer. The Simmentals we have also been excellent mothers, great milking ability and doability, and also structurally quite sound and fertile, so a real win for us and quite easy doing in the climate that we're in up here.
What characteristics are you specifically looking for?
So with our cattle, hopefully we're starting to see it a little bit more. Cattle that are long, easy doing, a little bit more moderate in frame. We don't want the cattle to be, you know, 800 or 900 kilos at 2 year old. We want them to be a little bit more moderate, a bit more easy doing. Structure's a big thing for us. They need to be able to get around and they need to have that longevity that we like to see. Also the ability to rear calves and have them turn off at a good weight at weaning and then to get back in calf 3 months later and do it all again in that 12-month cycle.
It must have been quite a steep learning curve. You started this stud in 2013 with no previous stud experience or...?
A little bit. So probably started 9 years ago through the Sheffield School Cattle Handling Program where we got assigned to breeders. So Reg and Rebecca, who I work for now, Woody Wiss of Royston, Solaires and Shorthorns. I started with the Solaires and then the last probably 5 or 6 years has gone to the Pole Shorthorns themselves. So a lot of stud experiences in breeding wise has come from them and a few other friends. Hayley Bennett, she's got Dame Lee Simmentals at Ulverston. So they've both been quite instrumental in the setting up and the establishing of the stud. Also just meeting like-minded people and different Simmental and Shorthorn breeders. They've all given us helpful words of advice and bits and pieces of wisdom to get us all set up. So I think we're at a stage now where we're just developing and fine-tuning the cattle and the information that we can provide on them.
You're obviously very passionate about the beef industry. Why is that?
I think it's got a good future and I think it's something that we need to be inspiring our next generation to keep coming up with, especially with all the pressure that's been put on us, on the producers now from animal activist groups and that sort of thing. I think we need to keep painting the image that 95% of the farming industry and the agricultural industry is actually a good place to work. It treats animals and everything ethically as well. So I think it's just a good experience to be able to develop and establish it and then try and promote that to other people, both old and young, to try and further push what we're trying to achieve.
You've won the TAS Women in Ag Scholarship this year. Congratulations.
Thank you.
What made you apply?
I've heard really good things about the Marcus Oldham Rural Leadership Program. Through Pie Harvest, I've been fortunate enough to work with Robin Burgesson, who's been a past attendee of this course, also through a couple of connections on the mainland through the beef cattle who have attended the course have said it's a wonderful opportunity. So Robin was actually the one that inspired me to actually apply for the scholarship and just said, well, nothing lost, nothing gained sort of thing.
What are you hoping to get out of it?
I think that being a member, so the last 3 years being a member of the Tasmanian Junior Beef Expo, I think that having that event sort of encompasses everything that I feel passionate about in the beef industry, bringing the youth through, teaching them the ways, how I sort of learnt 10 years ago myself now. So using the leadership course, I'd like to fine tune those leadership skills and obviously put back into that industry that I quite feel like. I'd also like to further develop them. I have aspirations of becoming a livestock agent, so hopefully develop and fine tune again to maybe not necessarily be a leader but be someone that's well respected and regarded in the community and then go from there.
And that was Chelsea Rayner, Simmental and Pole Shorthorn stud breeder from Sheffield, chatting to Hugh Hogan.
Saturday morning down the garden path.
Now, I do have something serious to talk to you about, Tino.
With Tino and Joel.
I hear that you've been eating another man's tomatoes, Tino.
When there's no callers, all options are on the table.
There's a lot of tomato love to go around, Joel. There's more than enough to go
around. I don't want you spreading your tomato love around, Tino. I thought we had an exclusive tomato deal going on between us here.
I thought we were very open here, Joel.
Keep the calls coming and get Tino and Joel back on message. Saturday mornings on ABC Radio Hobart.
You're with Fiona Breen for the Tasmanian Country Hour on ABC Radio Hobart and Tasmania.
And millions of dollars of funding is yet to be delivered to one of Australia's largest rural organisations. The Country Women's Association was set to receive $5 million from the federal government after it was announced in the latest budget. But the money still hasn't been released. And some of the CWA's state branches are running out of funding to help drought-affected farmers and their families. Joanna Woodburn spoke to the group's national president, Tanya Cameron.
So we've received confirmation of the funding in the form of a letter from Senator McKenzie, and we also have had some correspondence with members of the drought task force who are overseeing this particular money. But no, since we've gone into caretaker mode, the funding is, we're in limbo, just waiting to see whether that funding is still going to be forthcoming after the election.
Well, what's your response to the fact initially that the money hasn't been made available yet?
Look, our concern mostly is for people who are requiring some assistance. Some of the states still have public donations that are available. Other states are running short of funding. We are aware that the need is still significant, and it would be nice to be able to provide that funding or at least some, you know, indication of what's happening.
Do you think it's a fair response of the government to, albeit maybe indirectly, say that it's because the government is in caretaker mode?
I can't say whether it's a fair response or not. I don't understand what the hold-up is if the money is sitting there. You know, I understand the process. There is a process to be followed, and we need to provide the information that's been requested of us, which we are working on. But it would be ideal, probably, if we could get some degree of certainty around the funding being made available after the election. And now that isn't necessarily the incumbent's role. It's probably also an indication from the opposition or whoever might be in government after the election as to whether the funding will be provided as promised in the budget.
In a statement, a spokesperson for the Regional Services Minister, Bridget McKenzie, said the money was in the 2019 budget and will be on it if the coalition is re-elected on Saturday. Now, the skyrocketing land price is putting a major squeeze on processors and forcing some to trade at a loss. Pens of lambs are regularly making close to 800 cents a kilo at the sale yards. And just yesterday, a record of $300 a head was set at Ballarat. Robert Frew, Managing Director of Fruitstall in Stawell, Victoria, says his business can't turn a profit at current prices.
Oh, it means we can't purchase them, process them, and get out of get anything out of them. It's a loss scenario for our business.
So, what are you doing then?
We've still got to keep the plant going. So, you just do the best you possibly can. You buy what you can buy and process what you can process to keep the staff on.
So, you've already scaled back now?
We've only just started scaling back oh so slightly, but if the prices remain the way they are for the next 2 or 3 months, we'll probably have to drop back to a 4-day production week.
And does that mean you'll have to put off staff?
Probably we try not to, because you can't sort of replace them when you need to get them back again. So we just send people on holidays. We've been quite busy for a fair period of time now, so we have a lot of holidays. The staff have a lot of holidays they could possibly use for the next 2 or 3 months.
So you said it's a loss-making scenario. Are you even close to breaking even?
Well, we've got different markets, and some you can, some you can't. So it's pretty much a numbers game. So it just depends on how quickly we can get our wholesale or retail prices up for our customers, and if we can get them up, then we can break even. But I think, look, if lambs stay as dear as they are, naturally everybody's going to stop eating lamb, and and it'll slow down naturally anyway, and I think that hopefully will correct the price as we come into the next season, spring lambs.
And how readily are you actually able to pass on those extra costs?
When they jump up quite quickly, it's very difficult. But we've been putting our prices up every week for the last 3 or 4 weeks, and we'll probably continue for the next 10 to 12 weeks, and we'll just see how high we can get them.
And on the buying side of the equation, how competitive is the market at the moment, both with forward contracts and at the sale yards?
It's always competitive. It's very competitive, and with probably the shortage of stock, it's going to become more competitive. So it's going to get more and more difficult, hence one of the reasons we may have to cut back to 4 days, because it may be too difficult to get enough lambs to process over the 5 days anyway.
Last year, we didn't see those prices really peak until August, early September. Are you concerned that prices will keep rising through to then again this year?
They may stay high for a while, but I think they will eventually correct themselves as everybody pulls their production back.
Is it tough for the business going into a second winter of very high prices?
Look, it's always the meat industry is always tough. We have high turnover, low margins, so we always seem to work our way through it. So, look, everyone's in the same boat. So I think it'll eventually correct itself, but it's not what we were hoping for. We were hoping for the lambs to sort of stay around that 700 cents to sort of 750, but no, they're getting too dear now.
What sorts of prices are you being forced to pay at the moment?
Oh, look, we've had a few lambs around us, so we just follow everybody else, and we're follow the big exporters, I suppose, and just obviously we'll be up into the 800 cents very shortly for the lambs that we're purchasing.
And that was Robert Frew, our Victorian lamb processor. Now joining me now is Richard Bailey. Richard, welcome to Wednesday.
G'day, Fiona. How are you going?
Pretty good, thank you.
Good.
What do you think of those tough times for that processor in Victoria?
It's interesting, isn't it? Just a little background. It's actually the same plant where our Woolworths lambs from Tassie have been killed after the close of Devonport. So I know a little bit about that plant. Yeah, I suppose from an exporter point of view, at least the dollar, you know, has slipped down under 70 cents and that's got to be better for them. It's driven, I think, mainly by the export market. So it'll be interesting to see, but I think, as Robert just said, hard to see it probably coming much under 800 cents through the winter months, but interesting times ahead, I'd say.
Yeah, well, it'd be interesting to see if people keep eating lamb at the high prices.
Yeah, I don't think there'll be much. I doubt whether there'll be much difference. Look, at the end of the day, if you have a look in supermarkets, they've edged up a little bit here and there, but by gee, it hasn't been dramatic. I think you'll find that our lamb industry in this current cycle will be driven by the export market, and particularly into China and Southeast Asia, plus on top of that into the American market and the Middle East market.
With just a minute and a bit to go, can you tell us about the markets?
Yeah, well, not many cattle yesterday. Most of them were cows, and they met a little bit better market. Heavy cows made 170 to 189 cents a kilo, and medium weights 166 to 180 cents. An extra buyer in the market probably just made a little difference. The averages were about 10 cents better there. Over in the sheep and lamb markets, they were very strong again, and the best lineup of heavy lambs we've had for a while, and they sold very, very well. The extra heavy lambs topped at $206, so we went from anywhere from 170 to 206. Heavy lambs anywhere from 156 to 162, and then tradies anywhere from sort of 145 up to that 160 mark. Over in the mutton market was where the records were broken. I don't think I've ever seen sheep make $179 to kill. And it wasn't for two or three, it was for a line of 100 and something. So we had another line of sheep that made $178. So huge numbers of sheep over $130. Same as I said a couple of weeks ago, just be careful of very light sheep with no cover. They do get a bit of a kick in the neck, but very, very strong right throughout, Fiona.
That's incredible. Those mutton prices are still so high.
Yeah, unbelievable. It probably triggers what Robert Frew just said.
5 seconds to go. Thank you very much, Richard.
It probably
Bailey.
Just triggers what Robert said, and that is that, you know.
Catch you. We'll have to catch you on Friday.